We'll hear argument first this morning in number 85-1581, Richard Solorio versus United States. Mr. Bruce, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the question presented in this case is whether the offenses committed by the petitioner off-base and off-duty in Juneau, Alaska, are subject to court-martial jurisdiction. The Court of Military Appeals' decision in this case should be reversed for two reasons, which I'd like to discuss. First, the facts of this case do not establish a service connection. Second, the Court of Military Appeals found that there was court-martial jurisdiction in this case because it employed an erroneous and deficient service connection test. This Court has recognized that the special needs of the military justify a unique military justice system, but it is also recognized that court-martial jurisdiction should be limited to the least possible power adequate to the end proposed. In this Court's O'Callaghan and Relford decisions, it has limited court-martial jurisdiction by requiring that a service connection be established before a service member can be tried for civilian-type offenses committed off-base. The purpose of this service connection requirement is to balance the interests of the service member in the greater protections of a civilian trial against the military interest in trying the case at a court-martial. The criteria...
We're speaking only now of the alleged Alaska offenses, are we not?
That's correct, Justice.
Not the New York ones.
Not the New York offenses.
Have the Alaska authorities indicated any interest in prosecution?
The Alaska authorities have given a tentative deferral of prosecution to the Coast Guard, but there were also indications of interest on the part of Alaska in the record. In the record, it indicated that Alaska was continuing to investigate allegations of charges against other daughters of civilians in the community there. And there was also a message from the Coast Guard that indicated that the state of Alaska had previously, and fairly recently previously, prosecuted Coast Guardsmen for similar offenses.
But these particular victims and their fathers are no longer there.
That's correct, Justice Blackmun. The criteria that are relevant to the balancing test have been limited so that the infinite permutations of possibly relevant factors will not cause confusion about the proper limits of court-martial jurisdiction. And the outcome of the balancing test depends on the facts in each case. In this case, there's no military interest that outweighs the petitioner's interest in the greater protections of a civilian trial. Now, the limits on court-martial jurisdiction are not based solely on the fact that court-martials do not give service members all of the protections that they would receive in a civilian trial. The military justice system was created to serve a fundamentally different purpose than the purpose of civilian courts. The military justice system is a tool for maintaining discipline in the military. And another reason for limiting court-martial jurisdiction is the historic disapproval of trying ordinary crimes at court-martial.
When you say historic disapproval, I mean, O'Callaghan decided, what, 68, 69, was a departure from virtually a century of precedent. There was no disapproval prior to O'Callaghan.
Well, the O'Callaghan decision basically goes through the history, especially at the time of the founding of this country, and also the history of our English ancestors, and basically states that there has been a disapproval of generally trying civilian-type offenses by court-martial.
Well, certainly not in this country. Look at all the cases that O'Callaghan impliedly overruled from this court.
Well, that it did perhaps impliedly overturn these decisions, but it was
part of a... Well, then where do you get your historic disapproval from in this country?
Well, even after the founding of this country, O'Callaghan seems to indicate that there was a period of time when in this country most ordinary offenses were not tried by court-martial. And certainly for a court-martial to try to court-martial a dependent or a military contractor for an ordinary type of crime would be disapproved.
Disapproved by whom and when?
Well, it would be disapproved by this court. This court has decided... Now,
before O'Callaghan?
As I say, I believe that the founding fathers had the history of our ancestors in England.
Well, do you think then the early cases from this court didn't properly reflect this view of the founding fathers?
I don't think the early decisions of this court directly address this particular issue.
I think your statement there's a historic disapproval in this country isn't supported by those early cases. I mean, O'Callaghan was a sharp departure from the precedents of this court, I think.
Well, it was an extension, I believe, of some cases that had started to limit jurisdiction over people like military contractors and dependents. The Court of Military Appeals did not apply this court's Relford service connection analysis in this case. It totally ignored or unjustifiably minimized petitioner's interest in the greater protections of a civilian trial. But even so, if the Court of Military Appeals had applied the Relford criteria, it would have found that the service connection question here isn't even close. The facts of this case simply do not show a significant impact from these offenses on the Coast Guard. The petitioner in this case is an enlisted man in the Coast Guard. At a court-martial convened at the Coast Guard base on Governor's Island, he was charged with 21 specifications alleging sexual molestation of four girls. 14 of the specifications alleged offenses against two of the victims committed off-base and off-duty in Juneau, Alaska. These are the offenses that the trial judge dismissed for lack of a service connection. The seven remaining specifications alleged offenses against two different victims on-base at Governor's Island. Jurisdiction over these offenses has never been contested. All of the victims are the daughters of Coast Guardsmen. The government has tried to establish a service connection in this case by asserting every imaginable impact on the Coast Guard that could possibly result from the effect of these offenses on the victims and their fathers. Factually, however, the government was unable to prove any significant or direct impact on the Coast Guard at trial. As the trial judge properly found, any impact was remote or indirect, and any military interest in these offenses could be adequately vindicated in a civilian trial. When make-weight arguments concerning non-dispositive factors are stripped away from the Court of Military Appeals decision, it's clear that it's based entirely on the dependent status of the victims. The Court of Military Appeals did discuss two other factors that are unrelated to the dependent status of the victims. That is, the pendency of other court-martial charges and the difficulties that the state of Alaska might face in prosecuting the petitioner. These are simply make-weight arguments, however. They have nothing to do with the impact of these offenses on the Coast Guard. And factors such as these are too easily manipulated and too far removed from the real interests that should be balanced to be helpful in setting clear limits on court-martial jurisdiction. Because of the dependent status of the victims, the Court of Military Appeals also discussed the nature of the offenses and the age of the victims. It found that these offenses made the fathers less effective and unwilling to serve with the petitioner in the future. From this, it inferred that their units would suffer some loss of morale. This overstated and rather unlikely loss of morale is really the only arguably direct impact on the Coast Guard that the Court of Military Appeals discussed.
Mr. Bruce, could you give me another example, or the one that you would consider the closest, where a threshold question of whether the court has jurisdiction over the matter is to be determined on the basis of, what do we have, 21 factors, and I assume that they're not exhaustive. What is there a comparable area of the law where we've gotten ourselves into that kind of a fix, that you don't even know what court is supposed to dispose of the matter until you engage in the kind of balancing test that you're talking about?
Offhand, Justice Scalia, I can't think of one. But that doesn't mean that there aren't others. Another problem with this inference that based on the impact of these offenses on the victims and the fathers is that these kind of inferences can be drawn from any serious offense against a dependent victim. Therefore, holding that these kind of factors are significant is tantamount to holding that the dependent status of the victim by itself is sufficient to establish a service connection. But basically, whether or not the Court of Military Appeals decision is viewed as resting entirely on the dependent status of the victims or other factors, it should be reversed because it relied on an erroneous service connection test that did not require proof of a military interest or that military interest outweighed the petitioner's interest in a civilian trial. The Court of Military Appeals decision glossed over the fact that the trial judge applied all of the Relford criteria in this case and didn't find a single one that supported service connection.
Here speaks of the military interest in so many words.
Well, I think O'Callaghan and Relford and also this Court's Schlesinger decision all imply that there's a balancing here between the military's interest in prosecuting the case and the service member's interest in trial at a civilian court.
But they don't really say that, do they?
Justice White, that's my reading of the cases.
Well, do you find the words military interest in the O'Callaghan?
No, sir. I think the closest
or the word balance.
I think the closest that comes to that is perhaps a language in Schlesinger that basically summarizes the service connection test when it indicates that that there should be a unique military interest that can't be adequately vindicated in a civilian court. Now, admittedly, that's just a summarization. It's a kind of a shorthand and doesn't take in all of the factors that have to go into the test. But I think it indicates that's where the crisis comes.
You don't, I take it you're not urging that there must be some finding that military discipline will be disturbed or interfered with.
I think that's one of the main justifications.
But not essential.
Well, the other one would be something that affected
well,
them.
Is it essential or not? That's my question.
No, sir. The other thing that would
that's
trigger
all,
it.
That's all I really ask.
Yes, sir. The other thing that would trigger it would be an impact on the mission of the military. I think something that affected discipline or the mission of the military would justify court-martial jurisdiction. The
Well, but is that just a restatement of the service-connected language in O'Callaghan, which you've just said, or is that a narrowing or a broadening of O'Callaghan?
I intended it to be just a restatement of the language in O'Callaghan.
On the base, would there be court-martial jurisdiction?
I believe that under the Relford decision, if they had occurred on a military base, there would be court-martial jurisdiction.
Even though the victims were the same?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And, all right, thank you.
What if the victims were not related to military personnel? The base factor alone enough? I mean, I thought the base factor was just one of the 12.
I think that the Relford decision has indicated that a crime of violence or that violates property on a military base it may be sufficient to justify service connection. Yes. Excuse me, Justice White. The service connection analysis applied by the Court of Military Appeals is not bound by the result that this court's service connection analysis, this court's Relford service connection analysis requires. Rather, it seems that any military interest is sufficient to outweigh the petitioner's interest in a civilian trial. The Court of Military Appeals seems to have embraced the position of one writer who suggested that the imagination of the prosecutor is the only limitation on court-martial jurisdiction now. The Court of Military Appeals service connection analysis is so flexible it's meaningless. It permits military courts to base jurisdiction on any single factor or combination of factors, tangible or intangible, proven or presumed. It invites the confusion that this court has eliminated by its remarkably clear Relford decision. The Court of Military Appeals analysis doesn't set any limits.
You've divided up argument with the amicus, but is either you or the amicus going to address the portion of the Solicitor General's brief that urges that if we agree with you that the factors in Relford were not met, that we should overrule Relford and O'Callaghan?
Yes, sir.
Because if the amicus is not going to address that, I'd like to talk to you about it.
Justice Scalia, I believe Mr. Fidel is going to address that point. The Court of Military Appeals analysis doesn't set any limits on the factors that can be considered. It sets the law of service connection back to the time before the Relford decision, when there was concern that the infinite permutations of possibly relevant factors would cause confusion about the proper limits of court-martial jurisdiction. This court's Relford decision is especially clear and helpful. It sets out an analytic framework based on definite criteria. Those Relford criteria should be the touchstone for any service connection analysis. Even accepting for argument's sake that those criteria are not exhaustive, that doesn't justify the Court of Military Appeals ignoring the Relford criteria and deciding the service connection question in this case solely on the basis of a few other factors. If there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Fidel.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. First, if I may respond briefly to a question that Justice Blackmun raised during Commander Bruce's presentation. On page 67 of the joint appendix, there is a stipulation which indicates that if the Coast Guard were to determine that the court-martial were without jurisdiction to prosecute the Alaska offenses, the district attorney's office would reconsider its decision not to prosecute, so that there's no sense in this case that the state has washed its hands of the matter. It's simply waiting to see the outcome. There are, we submit, no reasons to reconsider the O'Callaghan and Relford cases. There are three possibilities that might lead the court, as a conceptual matter, to reconsider one of its prior decisions. One would be, for example, if it proved that the historic data on which an earlier decision had been predicated were incorrect or incomplete. The government has pointed to nothing in this case that cast doubt on the historical materials that were presented earlier, and we know of nothing that we can add to what was before the court when O'Callaghan was decided. A second factor that might lead the court to reconsider a prior determination would be if the test had proven to be unworkable. But that also is not the case with respect to the O'Callaghan and Relford decisions. The O'Callaghan and Relford decisions, although they've generated some decisions, some decisional law in the military and in the Article III courts, have not presented a substantial problem.
Well, one reason to reconsider O'Callaghan would be if we simply felt it was wrong as a matter of constitutional law. And, of course, those questions are always open.
That question, obviously, is always on the table, Mr. Chief Justice. And yet, I would submit that the decision is not wrong, and certainly not so clearly wrong, that would lead the court to overturn a precedent that has...
It has to be clearly wrong rather than just wrong before we overturn.
I think it should be very clearly wrong, but be that as it may, I don't think this is clearly wrong. I don't think it was wrong at all, in fact. I think the court was on good ground, and I frankly think that subsequent history has proven the court's judgment to have been a profoundly wise matter.
Mr. Fidel, you say that it hasn't created any decisional problems. The briefs all address the problem of drug offenses, and I gather that the Court of Military Appeals has taken the position that drug offenses are automatically related, wherever they occur and so forth. Is that right?
Not quite, Justice Scalia. The position of the Court of Military Appeals with respect to drug offenses, which obviously are not this case, there's nothing in the record about drug offenses, effect of drug use on the performance of duty and so on. So it's not really an appropriate vehicle to get into that, and I think that will be an appropriate mm-hmm. vehicle. But the position of the Court of Military Appeals has varied over the years, mm-hmm. basically as I read the precedents, as the membership of the court has changed. For some time, there was a per se rule in the Beaker case, and that was overruled in 1976. There was a subsequent rule. At the moment, the rule is not a 100% any drug case.
Not at the moment, but it has been.
For a while, but that was departed from.
Well, here's my problem with it. O'Callaghan and Relford being constitutional decisions, every case has to decide the jurisdictional question on the basis of a rational line. Does it so much affect the military and so forth? That's a very difficult process, and it's very fact-bound. Now, if we said that that it isn't a matter of constitutional law, that it's up to the Congress, if Congress doesn't want all of this stuff in the military courts, they can take it out, and they can adopt a clear line that says all drug offenses will be tried by military personnel, will be tried in military courts. One cannot arrive at any clear lines by constitutional interpretation on a question of jurisdiction that, to the extent possible, ought to be clear.
Well, if Congress had taken the matter in hand, it might be a different question, but they haven't taken it in hand, and it wasn't appropriate, in fact. It's not appropriate, I think, to...
Well, they couldn't take it in hand once we tell them it's a constitutional point.
Yes, that's correct. But I would quarrel with the assumption that there has been a substantial problem in terms of understanding the parameters of what the O'Callaghan decision and the Relford decision say.
There have been... I don't know what I would do with a particular drug offense, and I think it would be very difficult to say as a constitutional matter whether all drug offenses are in or out. Seems to me a hard point.
Well, but it's a point that the Court of Military Appeals and the other military courts have been grappling with. The law grows. The military courts are, in this sense, no different from any other court under the Constitution, that it grows as a decisional matter. And with increasing experience and as more is learned, for example, about the science and the toxicological aspects of drug use, all of which I feel somewhat uncomfortable about discussing in this case because this is not a drug case. And I don't think this should be, okay, I think we understand one another on that.
About the forgery and fraud cases?
You're thinking, I think, Justice White, of the Lockwood case. And the problem with the Lockwood case was a chain of events that began on base and had to do with the larceny of a wallet on base and the larceny and use of a government identification card. So far, we have no problem with what the Court of Military Appeals did in that case. It's what they said in that case that gives us a lot of trouble. And that, I think, was where the train went off the tracks in terms of the O'Callaghan and Relfer analysis. That was the beginning of the substantial confusion as to what O'Callaghan and Relfer said. Indeed, I don't think there was confusion then. I don't think there's confusion now. It takes only a page and a half in the manual for courts martial for the President to furnish a restatement of the law of service connection. It's not a confusing area. It was pretty much established by 1970. Particularly as regard the specific narrow issue in this case, which is it enough that the victim happened to be a dependent?
Well, you could restate the law of torts in a couple of lines. That doesn't make it clear.
I need more time.
Thing that a reasonable man wouldn't.
But the problem, Justice Scalia, is it might be my last clear chance. I'd like to point out that there are some anomalies that flow from the decision of the Court of Military Appeals. For example, how can it be, and I'm referring here to the notion of the non-base base, how can it be that the less base the Coast Guard has in Juneau, the greater the district commander's responsibility for his personnel? That's an irrational outcome. Or why should it make a difference to look, for example, at the danger to morale? Why should it make a difference for purposes of military jurisdiction whether or not the victim is a dependent of a member of the Coast Guard or a dependent of a member of the Navy? Many towns are both Navy towns and Coast Guard towns. Or why should it make a difference if the victim was a dependent of a member of the Coast Guard but assigned to some other unit where the morale issue wouldn't take place? And indeed, I'd like to draw the Court's attention to another point in the Joint Appendix. There was testimony on page 101. Would the reputation of the Coast Guard be enhanced if the Coast Guard turned the individual who was charged over to the Alaska State authorities? And the answer from a government witness was, I think it would, yes. And that's the answer to the problem. If you have a concern that people in the Coast Guard are going to feel angry that their, let's call them shipmates, even though they work in a federal building, are going to escape punishment, that would be one thing. But there's no issue of that here. What people, according to that witness, want is they want to make sure that the Coast Guard is going to assist the local authorities who have primary jurisdiction for law and order in the community. That's where these offenses in Juneau took place. And the only problem was that if somebody misled the district attorney into thinking there might be court-martial jurisdiction here and that maybe he wouldn't have to prosecute this case, a disservice was done to that district attorney. And it's a disservice that's easily remedied. I would like to, if I have a moment, comment briefly on the Bowie and Marx issue, only to suggest that Solorio was deprived of two things of value by the decision of the Court of Military Appeals. Number one, he was deprived of a complete defense to the court-martial because the Court of Military Appeals changed the rules on him. Number two, because the U.S. and Alaska are separate sovereigns, the punishment is additive. It is cumulative. The consequence is that the net punishment to which Solorio was exposed is exposed has been increased on him. That is a black-letter violation of ex post facto analysis. I would also comment that there's no notion here about reliance interests being frustrated. Reliance plays no role in our submission on this issue. Suppose, for example, an accused was ignorant, subjectively ignorant, of what the punishment was for a particular offense, and then
using up your colleague's rebuttal time.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rehnquist. And then his offense was committed, and thereafter the legislature changed the penalty. Can there be any question but that violates the ex post facto clause? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fidel. We'll hear now from you, General Fried.
In this case, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In this case, petitioner was convicted of preying sexually on the young daughters of fellow servicemen on and off base in Alaska and New York. The Coast Guard Court of Military Review and the Court of Military Appeals found that such charges were sufficiently service-connected to justify trial by the military authorities.
The military judge, however, found otherwise.
That is correct, Justice Blackmun.
Was it on base in Alaska?
In Alaska, it was off base.
Off base
in New York,
the
offenses were on base.
But the New York offenses are not at issue here.
They are not at issue here. They are relevant to our considerations, Justice Blackmun, because one of the reasons that it is appropriate to have military trial here is so that the whole set of offenses can be disposed of in one proceeding. The power of Congress to prohibit and to provide for court-martial jurisdiction of such offenses is the power in the Constitution to make rules for the government and regulation of the law and naval forces. The exception in the Fifth Amendment grand jury clause for cases arising in the land or naval forces is not so much a grant of authority as an acknowledgement that that congressional authority was there in Article I of the Constitution. Until O'Callaghan, it was quite clear and was restated many times in the Reed v. Covert case, in Toth v. Quarles, and Kinsella v. Singleton that, and I quote here from Singleton, the test for jurisdiction is one of status, whether the accused can be regarded as falling within the term land or naval forces. That is the language of Article I. O'Callaghan added to this test an additional requirement that the crime be service-connected in what this court characterized as a clear break with the past. Taking this case at its narrowest, we ask the court to affirm the judgment that the tendency of such crimes is sufficiently poisonous of military morale and for the indispensable relations of trust which should obtain between service members that they satisfy the O'Callaghan test and are indeed service-connected. We submit that taking the paraphrase and expansion of O'Callaghan in Councilman in the 1974 term, gauging the impact of an offense on military discipline and effectiveness, that the O'Callaghan test is amply satisfied here. The argumentation by petitioner and amici have taken us far afield from this simple truth about this case. Particularly, they make rather heavy weather of the Relford decision and its 21 criteria. And I think they miss the point about what Relford represented in the law when Relford came along after the shock to the system which O'Callaghan represented. Relford was decided two terms after O'Callaghan and performed the signal and the clarifying service of laying down a categorical per se rule. All offenses by service members on base, the serious offenses, are subject to court-martial jurisdiction. So what you had there was a per se categorical rule. That's the principal effect of Relford. Now, in order to justify and to explain that rule, and further to give guidance, because the Relford Court said that that per se rule marked an area perhaps not the limit, in order to give further guidance, the Court did lay down, in addition, 21 factors. What petitioner and amici do is to overlook the fact that Relford lay down a categorical per se rule of the sort we seek here, and to suggest that each case requires the courts to solve a system of equations in 21 unknowns before they can decide whether they have jurisdiction. That, it seems to me, turns Relford on its head. We urge, first of all, that on its individual facts, and second, as a categorical matter, this case, and cases like it, which involve serious depredations against military defendants by members of the armed services, be admitted within the limits set out by Relford, and that this be done by a per se rule such as Relford itself set out. First of all, it should be noted that in Relford, the status of the victims as persons connected to the armed forces, there was a military dependent there, was specifically mentioned by the court. Second, it would be, we think, an anomaly to be concerned for the integrity of the topographical limits of the command and to overlook the fact that the integrity of a command is, after all, an integrity of an organization of people. But there is, as Justice Scalia has pointed out during the petitioner's argument, the looming problem of off-base drug offenses. This is not a drug case, to be sure. But the issue is, has the Court of Military Appeals Trottier decision in 1980, which creates, again, a categorical rule for off-base drug offenses, with very little exception, is that an improper understanding of this court's jurisprudence? If it is, then the very successful approach to drug offenses which the military has had is cast in doubt by the kind of procedure, by this complex eschewing of any kind of categorical approach which the petitioners urge on the court today. Finally, we urge that the court fulfill the work of Relford by returning the law to what it was when it was announced in such landmark decisions as Reed v. Covert, Toth v. Quarles, Kinsella against Singleton, and throughout the whole history of our Constitution, which is that service, that membership in the service was a sufficient condition for court-martial jurisdiction.
You want to go back then to the old status argument?
We do indeed, Justice Blackmun. We think that returning to the status argument, as it was announced in cases like Reed and Toth and Kinsella, which were, after all, greatly concerned with the civil liberties issues which concern the petitioners, going back to that rule would be no violent unsettling of the law at all. It was O'Callaghan.
It would merely overrule O'Callaghan.
It would merely...
That Relford, of course.
It would overrule O'Callaghan. Relford started a process of narrowing O'Callaghan, and it did so in a very substantial way because it set down that per se categorical rule for all on-base offenses by service members. And the point about O'Callaghan is that if we pull this one thread, which we think is a bad thread in the fabric, it would require no unraveling of the fabric of the law. There has been only one decision since O'Callaghan in which this court once again considered the service connection decision, and that was Relford, which was a considerable narrowing, I would say taming, of O'Callaghan itself. And indeed, even...
General Fried, if we're, before you go further on the constitutional point, let's assume we stand by Relford. I don't understand why you think it affects military discipline or morale. If, let's say, I'm an officer on a base, and I learn that another officer, or enlisted man for that matter, is a child molester,
I can understand how that might affect military discipline or morale. But I don't know why it would affect it any more if I found out that, moreover, the child that this officer or enlisted man molested was a military child, not on the base, somewhere else. Why would that have any incremental effect whatever upon the morale of the unit? I mean, the fact that you have a child molester in the unit, I can understand. But what difference does it make that the child is a child of another serviceman?
It seems to me, Justice Scalia, to make an enormous difference, because we are talking about the esprit and the sense of comradeship which is supposed to obtain within the military services. So preying upon dependence of your fellow service members, in addition to being a pretty deplorable offense, is an offense to the relation of trust and comradeship which is supposed to obtain within the military services, and is an indispensable condition of the kind of morale and trust which is supposed to obtain people who serve on ships together, whose lives depend on the exact performance of duty. It seems to me that comradeship is an important factor, not an irrelevance, and was so judged to be by the Court of Military Appeals. That's the best answer I can offer to you. It was thought to be a powerful one by the courts below.
He's a thief, but he doesn't steal from his comrades. That's enough. I mean.
Stealing from his comrades does aggravate the offense and does indeed implicate the concerns of the military, is the argument we are submitting. That is correct, Justice Scalia. It should be noted, and it's a matter of very great importance, that the O'Callaghan decision on its own terms is by now at least obsolete. O'Callaghan was tried, though the case was decided in the 69-68 term. O'Callaghan had been tried in 1956 under the 1950 Uniform Code of Military Justice. That code has been twice revised since O'Callaghan was tried, and important changes have occurred in 1969 and again in 1983. The most important of these changes were, first of all, to remove both organizationally and in terms of evaluation, the military judge and the defense counsel from the command and from their designation by the convening authority. The convening authority no longer picks the military judge, as he did in O'Callaghan's time, no longer picks the defense counsel. That has been taken out of their hands. Furthermore,
what if they change back? Do we then change our constitutional interpretation once again and go back to O'Callaghan?
I would think not. I would think not. However, what O'Callaghan did indeed depend on was a description of the military justice system, which simply is not a correct description of the military justice system as it now obtains. It may be, Justice Scalia, that if the rule we propose, which is the pre-O'Callaghan rule of status only, were to be reinstated, aspects of the military justice system would be subject to review not on jurisdictional grounds, but on due process grounds. Indeed, the question of command influence, which has been very significantly addressed by both Congress and regulation since O'Callaghan has been tried, are issues which have been brought to this court and which, as recently as yesterday, the court denied certiorari in cases raising that issue. So it's not as if the O'Callaghan concerns might not be addressed. We suggest that they are not appropriately addressed in terms of a jurisdictional line. In fact, the very best example, the very best testimony for the current state of military justice, the independence and the zeal of the defense function has been the defense of this case in the courts below and in this court, both in the oral and written presentations. It seems to us that a system which nurtures such a system of advocacy against the extensions of its own authority cannot fairly be described, in Justice Douglas's mysterious term, as responding to the age-old manifest destiny of retributive justice. It seems to me that what we have seen exemplified here is a system of justice pure and simple, and that the congressional determination of what the jurisdiction of that system of justice is, the congressional determination, and the determination of this court up until O'Callaghan should be the determination which spells the limit of when that system of justice has power over a member of the armed forces. If there are no further questions, I thank
Did
the court.
Did you intend to address at all the ex post facto argument?
Well, the ex post facto argument troubles us a great deal because it does not seem to us to be properly here. Coast Guard Court of Military Review determined that there was service connection in this case and did so according to what I would call the intermediate ground which we ask from this court, that is to say, the categorical rule of dependency status. There was no ex post facto objection raised in the Court of Military Appeal from that objection, and therefore it seems to us that the issue is not properly here. It was waived, and we have not been able to discover in the petitioner's argumentation any response to this point. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, General Fried. Mr. Bruce, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. First of all, I'd like to address the suggestion that there should be a per se rule that any offense against a dependent should be service-connected. I believe it was in the case of Toth v. Quarles that this court pointed out that the purpose of the military is to fight wars, and that other things that it does tend to detract from that. And I would say that if all of the offenses against dependents are held to be service-connected, that's going to seriously detract from the military's primary purpose of fighting wars. I mean, you can obviously think of cases that are even further removed from any military interest in discipline or its military.
Well, that's a good policy argument, but that can be made to the Congress. We wouldn't be saying that it must be done this way. We'd just be saying that it can be. As a constitutional matter, it's permissible. Now, if Congress agrees with you that the military should expend its energies on something else, takes a stroke of the pen.
Well, Justice Scalia, I think it's really a constitutional issue. I mean, obviously there are limits on Congress's authority to expand court-martial jurisdiction.
And it isn't a constitutional issue. I mean, as a constitutional matter, the military should spend most of its energies fighting wars.
That's correct.
It's not a constitutional issue.
There are constitutional arguments to be made, and I believe that this court would be evading its duty if it deferred to the military courts when they exceed court-martial jurisdiction in a particular case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bruce, the case is submitted.